WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota. Thanks, Dave and Richard, for the Eclectic Blender, and you can hear Dave and Richard again in the new year, 2010. Gosh, what a big thing. You're listening to Truly Sustainable Sarasota. My name is Emily, and the first guest today is Kevin Camps. Kevin is on the line with us, and Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog from Beyond Nuclear, which is a non-profit organization that aims to educate and activate the public about the connections between nuclear power and nuclear weapons and the need to abandon both to safeguard our future. Good morning, Kevin. You're on the air?
Good morning, Emily.
Kevin, we were going to talk about, first of all, the news recently. There was a nuclear power plant in Canada that had a leak, and it was contaminated with tritium, and also in New York, there was a nuclear power plant that had a similar issue. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, just last week in Canada, near Toronto, at a nuclear power plant called Darlington, they had an overflow of a storage tank that drained directly into Lake Ontario. And the toxic chemicals that were involved in that leak were tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen, and hydrazine, which is a toxic chemical used to prevent corrosion on metal. And the mistake that was made was that the workers poured this contaminated water into a underground storage tank, and they chose the wrong one. They chose one that was already full, and the overflow drained directly into Lake Ontario through a pipe. So the dangers of tritium and hydrazine are, tritium is a cancer-causing radioactive material. It also causes birth defects. It's radioactive hydrogen, so it can integrate into the human body at the most intimate of levels, right down to the DNA, and that's where it can cause its genetic damage. And it can also initiate cancers. And hydrazine is a toxic chemical that the U.S. military, I guess it was early 2008, there was a satellite that contained hydrazine that was out of control, and they decided to shoot it down rather than have it reach the Earth's surface. So that may give some indication of how toxic hydrazine is. And the unfortunate thing, you mentioned a more recent leak just in the last few days at a nuclear power plant in upstate New York called Fitzpatrick, and that's on the Lake Ontario shoreline too. And this time, it looks like the tritium may also have been discharged into Lake Ontario because it was found in a place that is intentionally pumped free of water. And so chances are it got pumped out into Lake Ontario. And unfortunately, these tritium leaks are happening almost in epidemic proportions across the country at operating nuclear power plants.
Yet they're not something that we really hear about very much.
Yeah, unfortunately, the powers that be, so to speak, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear utilities themselves that own the nuclear power plants, because these leaks are so common, they are working very hard to downplay the health hazards. They call tritium a mildly radioactive substance, and they set the permissible doses, the permissible concentrations in water at a very high level. So it appears through all their shenanigans that things aren't really that serious. But when you start to look at the devil in the details, you see that different government agencies have different safety standards for tritium in water, and these differ by orders of magnitude. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is supposed to protect public health and safety, has a level of a million picocuries per liter. That's allowable for them for tritium in water. But the Environmental Protection Agency sets their limit under the Safe Drinking Water Act at 20,000 picocuries per liter. So those are order of magnitude differences.
So what kind of exposure or what kind of levels of exposure are people going to get from these two leaks that we do know about?
Well, that's where they take advantage of the situation that they're on Lake Ontario, and they say, hey, look, it leaked into Lake Ontario, which is this huge body of water, and it's going to dilute to safe levels. And what's false about that argument, the concentration from Canada was, I believe, 1,000 picocuries per liter. So it was even below the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency limit. But the thing is, the people who live in nearby communities and draw their drinking water from Lake Ontario are going to be exposed to a low dose of tritium over a long period of time. Because in addition to the leaks that are happening, this is the incredible part, the nuclear safety agencies in both the U.S. and Canada allow tritium to be discharged into waterways, into surface waters and groundwaters, as a matter of routine operations at nuclear power plants. So people, especially in the nearby communities, are being exposed to a low level of tritium over a long period of time. And the National Academy of Science has reported that there is no safe level of exposure to radioactivity, that any exposure can initiate a cancer or other health impacts. So the low-dose radiation does carry a health risk, and that's what they leave unsaid.
And I would imagine by being more of a continuous low dose rather than a one huge hit, it's going to have a more insidious effect, and perhaps cancers are going to take obviously longer to develop and maybe not be traced back to that exposure.
Yes, and one of the most vulnerable populations of all is the fetus in the womb, because tritium can cross the placenta from the mother. And that's another weakness in safety regulations, is that they are all based on what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission refers to as the standard man. And standard man is defined as a 25-year-old, healthy, white male. And this dates back to the 1940s when standard man was defined. But women, and especially the fetus, are much more vulnerable to radioactivity's harmful effects, and they are not being protected. So I mentioned the EPA has a 20,000 picocurie per liter permissible dose to tritium, while the state of California has decided that 400 is where they need to draw the line. So again, orders of magnitude in difference. Right now in the United States, California's is the strongest, most protective regulation.
How far does something like this travel? Do you have to live right next to a nuclear power plant to really be affected by it, or is this stuff going to travel really far?
It's going to travel really far. The closer you live to the nuclear plant, the more concentrated the tritium will be, so the more concentrated the radiation dose. But because it's radioactive hydrogen, it simply integrates into water molecules, for example. So it's not that the water is contaminated, it's that the water itself is radioactive, which is kind of a scary thought. But it will go anywhere that water goes, which is everywhere. And because there's such an epidemic of tritium releases around the country, there are some really crazy stories going on. Like in Arizona, at the Palo Verde nuclear power plant, their tritium leak has happened in a vapor form, and they actually have tritiated rain that falls there. They have tritium precipitation on the nuclear power plant site.
So this a case which was quite big in Canada and made the newspapers, obviously, not hugely, but did make some newspapers. That was through human error of accidentally dumping in the wrong thing. But you're talking about these other leaks. Are those due to faults in the design? Or old plants, or what causes the leaks?
Yeah, there's so much tritium being released, both intentionally and accidentally. So the reason that they permit intentional tritium releases is because tritium is hydrogen. It's very difficult to contain, and it's impossible to economically filter out of a waste stream. So because it's inevitable and inherent in operating a nuclear power plant that tritium is generated and has to go somewhere, they allow it to be released into the environment as long as they stay below a certain limit. And they take advantage of that, though. Like if they have a certain quantity of tritium that they want to release into the environment, they'll simply dilute it in enough water to make it legal to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But the accidents that are going on, you put your finger on it, there are design flaws in nuclear power plants that have allowed leaks. In Illinois, where this scandal of tritium releases really took off back in 2006, it was because the pipeline from the nuclear reactor to the river leaked on the way to the river, that's where the scandal unfolded. But as we've talked about, the releases into the river on a regular basis were intentional. So that was a design flaw. The pipe valves were stuck open, and the tritium just leaked into the groundwater. Where a significant part about tritium in groundwater is that it's very concentrated there. It doesn't dilute like it would in a lake or in the ocean. And then further accidents, you put your finger on it too, have to do with age-related degradation.
Mm-hmm.
As these pipes and systems age and corrode over time, then the leaks become worse. We got our hands on a Nuclear Regulatory Commission document from the early 1970s where they warned the nuclear utilities that they needed to keep very close watch on especially underground buried pipes that carry tritium. And to save money, the company simply did not do so. So we're finding that these underground pipes are badly corroded, and that's causing a lot of these leaks in the groundwater.
So are any actual studies being done like on the effects of this, or is it all just being whitewashed over?
Very few health studies are being done, and many times it takes a lot of citizen activism to force the government agencies to do the health studies. And there are some government agencies that we really don't trust, that are biased in favor of the industry. So it's a pertinent issue right now because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is considering even bidding out contracts to do new health studies on the carcinogeneity of radioactivity and nuclear power. And we really distrust the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So we're getting involved in that process to try to find an independent institution that can carry out that study. But we do have on our website, which is www.beyondnuclear.org, a number of studies, about 15 studies, on tritium's health hazard to humans.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very well established that tritium is a dangerous substance.
Now, tritium isn't the only dangerous substance being released by nuclear power plants, is it? You mentioned one other, but are there any other exposures that people can get?
Yeah, you're right. There are hundreds of radioactive poisons that are generated during the chain reaction in a nuclear reactor. So some of the most infamous are things like plutonium-239. Plutonium is perhaps the most dangerous substance humans have ever created. It just takes a microscopic speck in the human lung to initiate a lung cancer. Others are strontium-90, cesium-137, iodine-131. Those were three of the worst culprits that escaped during the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in Ukraine in 1986. And the hazardous lives of these poisons are incredible. Plutonium-239, it's a 24,000-year half-life, which means you got to multiply by 10 to get the hazardous persistence. So that's 240,000 years of hazard associated with plutonium.
So now there's a big push to try and sell nuclear power as the next clean energy, which obviously you're very opposed to. Is there any truth to what they say that at least with the new plants that they would be fail-proof and there wouldn't be these leaks?
No. There's actually a lot of evidence that new atomic reactors have a lot of design flaws and construction flaws that sometimes we don't find out about until the hard way. So some of the most infamous nuclear disasters in history, Three Mile Island in 1979, Chernobyl in 1986, those were brand new atomic reactors. They had design flaws that combined with human error led to, in Chernobyl, a catastrophe. And so that's kind of a inherent risk with atomic power, is that when you have new designs, you're going to make mistakes. It's inevitable. And the question is, how bad are the mistakes going to be? And then as the reactors age, even these new ones, these new designs, their systems will degrade, and you could have a problem in the future.
You've actually visited Chernobyl, haven't you, Kevin?
Yes, I have.
And what did you see there as far as the physical effects that it had on the people there during the...
Well, you name the disease, and it is happening in epidemic proportions in the Chernobyl region.
And it's still happening?
Yes, unfortunately. Even certain things like radioactive iodine-131 gas that escaped during the first days and weeks of the disaster, the damage was supposed to taper off over a number of years because only the people exposed directly to it were supposedly going to be damaged by it. But I spoke with thyroid pathologists in the country of Belarus, and they said that there must be a genetic component going on because there was no tapering off. The thyroid pathology in children was unheard of before Chernobyl. Maybe one case a year in the entire country. Now it's into the hundreds of cases, and there's no end in sight at this point.
And birth defects?
Yes, birth defects are also widespread. There are some great groups working to help these children and their families. It's a group called the Irish Chernobyl Children's Project is working in Belarus, and there are many groups working in Ukraine because there's a large Ukrainian-American population that's doing outreach there. So the Children of Chernobyl's Fund that's based in the New York City area is doing great work. They oftentimes will adopt orphanages that are real hellholes when they find them mm-hmm. due to lack of resources usually, and just pour resources into these places to try to bring them up to modern standards to help the kids.
Kevin, there's plans, unfortunately, like right here where we are in Florida, there's in Levy County, there are plans to build two more nuclear power plants. And also, I read a lot about plans trying to placate people and say we're replacing old plants. But when they shut down a plant, what happens to that? I mean, all the waste there and the actual property, isn't that very contaminated as well?
Yeah, if only they would shut down the old plants. The opposite is happening, actually. So that's a real deception that they're putting out there, because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is rubber stamping license extensions at the old reactors. These are 20-year license extensions, so instead of 40 years of operations, the reactors are being allowed to operate for 60 years, and now they're talking about 80 years of operations. So they're really just extending the lives of these dangerously deteriorated old reactors left and right. But the new plant, yeah, well, to answer your question, the property, the site where the old reactors have operated for so many decades is itself radioactively contaminated in the soil, in the groundwater, in the surface waters. And as long as they're operating, there will be releases into air of radioactivity and toxic chemicals. So even after shutting down, you've got the radioactive contamination that lingers. And then you've got the high-level radioactive waste, which has nowhere to go and is just piling up at these reactor sites. For as long as they operate, this will be in an indoor pool of water. But those are mostly full around the country. So even at operating reactors, they are transferring the older wastes into outdoor silos of concrete and steel. And those are growing in number.
Is there a big connection between the nuclear power industry and the nuclear arms industry? I mean, does one sort of support the other?
There are many connections, and this goes back to the very beginning of the Manhattan Project in the World War II era, but it continues to the present day. So some present day examples that are quite astounding are, for one, about 10 years ago now, and this was during the Clinton administration, actually, Energy Secretary Bill Richardson, who's currently the governor of New Mexico and has run for president a number of times, mm-hmm. he allowed for, again, here's the T word, tritium, to be generated for nuclear weapons purposes at reactors in the Tennessee Valley Authority fleet, so Watts Bar, Tennessee, and Sequoia. I think Sequoia is also in Tennessee. Excuse me. Tritium in nuclear weapons is the hydrogen of the hydrogen bomb. It is the the big jump from an atomic weapon to a hydrogen bomb is tritium. That's how it's used in there. And you need to generate it in a very pure form to be used in nuclear weapons. And this allowing of tritium to be generated in commercial electricity reactors was a huge decision, because what it means is that these commercial reactors in Tennessee are now a part of the nuclear weapons complex of the United States. And it's a really bad example to set, because the United States is trying to tell Iran not to use commercial nuclear facilities, as it claims, to build a nuclear weapon with. Well, we're doing it ourselves right here in the United States.
Yeah, that's very often the case, isn't it? Do as I say, not as I do. Kevin, what about the argument, we sort of touched on this briefly, but this is what's pushed and promoted so much, and this is the battle that's going on right now in Levy County, that people are being told that we can't get the power that we need unless we have nuclear, and, you know, the usual that it's a clean source and so on. But do you think we can bypass nuclear, hopefully, and actually produce enough power without it?
Yeah, the evidence of that is growing dramatically in recent years, too. There was a book written in 2007 by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, Dr. Arjun Makajani. It's called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. And Arjun, you know, cited solar thermal and solar photovoltaic as huge components of a nuclear-free, carbon-free energy system for the United States. Also, wind power, geothermal, ocean power. Energy efficiency is very vital, because we could save half the electricity that we currently generate in the United States if we had a more efficient system. So Arjun said that by 2040, we could be carbon-free and nuclear-free. We could phase out fossil fuels and nuclear power from our energy system. And he has not been attacked or criticized on the technical merits of his argument. And in fact, just recently, the Scientific American magazine published a very similar report. And Florida, of all places, has one of the biggest potentials for solar energy development. There's also big potential for wind power here, and of course the ocean potential. So the United States, of all countries in the world, has some of the best renewable energy potential to be had. And we're simply just being left in the dust by other countries that see the promise of renewable energy. Denmark is a world leader in wind power, as is Spain, as is Germany. The same can be said of solar power in Germany. And the incredible thing is that Germany, compared to the United States, has very limited resources. They are not a very sunny place. They're not an incredibly windy place, but they have put the policies in place and the technologies in place that they're making it happen in their country. And it's the way of the future, so the United States can either get on board or be left behind.
It's very bizarre, isn't it, that we've been fed this line in Florida, which is known as the Sunshine State, has so little solar power, and yet somewhere like you mentioned, like Germany, that is in virtual darkness the whole time and gray, actually is doing very well, thriving with it, and yet we're building more nuclear power stations here.
A lot of it has to do with the money and the subsidies that are in place and about to be put in place. So the big battlefront against these new reactors right now is the attempt by the nuclear utility companies to grab a lot of money from the U.S. Treasury in the form, mostly at this point, of what are called loan guarantees. And what it means is the U.S. taxpayer is the co-signer on these new reactor projects. So far, they've gotten approval for $18.5 billion in nuclear loan guarantees for new reactors. And interesting timing, the Department of Energy, which is in charge of the program, is probably today, because the Energy Secretary said by the end of this year that the $18.5 billion would at least begin to be distributed. And the top candidate on the Department of Energy's list to receive this loan guarantee is the Vogtle Nuclear Power Plant in Georgia, where they want to build two what are called advanced passive 1000, AP1000 reactors by the company Toshiba Westinghouse. And in the southeastern United States, where most of the new reactors are proposed in this country, most of those new reactors are these AP1000s. And you asked earlier about the inherent safety of the you know, new and advanced designs. Well, it turns out just a couple months ago, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is not a radical environmental organization by any means, publicly announced that the AP1000 has a major design flaw. So specifically, it is called the shield building. It's around the primary radioactivity containment. And apparently the structural engineering is so bad that there's big questions about whether it could withstand a hurricane, a tornado, an earthquake, or a terrorist attack. So what the NRC is really doing is they're pressuring the company, Toshiba Westinghouse, to redesign the shield building so that it lives up to safety standards. And incredibly, the Department of Energy is considering, and very likely today or in near future, to grant this design major federal backing at taxpayer risk. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that half of all new reactors will default on their loan repayments, and that means that the taxpayers will be left holding the bag for many billions of dollars per reactor, because a typical price tag for these new reactors is $10 billion apiece, and that price tag is just skyrocketing as time goes on.
Kevin, are you finding that the new administration is any easier to deal with on this, or any more likely to bring about changes and perhaps veer us away from the nuclear industry, or are they just playing along with it?
Sometimes it's hard to, you know, see the difference between the forest and the trees, but I think it's fair to say that the Bush-Cheney administration was radically pro-nuclear power. A McCain-Palin administration would have been much the same. There were calls for, it depended on the day, but sometimes they would call for 30 new reactors, 50 new reactors, 100 new reactors. The Obama administration is more in the single digits, but we're still very concerned about that. If they call for 7 new reactors out of the Obama administration, that's still 7 too many.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wrong turn. It's a dead end. It's a waste of money. A lot of the arguments for the new reactors is that it's a solution to the climate crisis, and this is just a total bogus claim, because there are much faster, cheaper, safer, cleaner ways to address the climate crisis, efficiency and various renewables. So nuclear is just, it's more expensive, it's more dangerous, it's dirtier in a lot of ways, and financially it's very risky. And the reason for the loan guarantee program is that Wall Street investors for over 30 years have turned their back on the nuclear power industry. But if these federal taxpayer loan guarantees are in place, then Wall Street will be all too happy to involve itself in these projects, because there will be no financial risk to them or to the utility companies that are building the plants. All the financial risk will be on the taxpayers.
Kevin, thank you very much for calling in and talking to us today. It's been certainly very informative. For more information, people can go to your website, and that's beyondnuclear.org.
That's right. And just put in the search engine Tritium, and you can find those health reports.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin, and you do a wonderful job, and your organization certainly is doing a wonderful job, so thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily, and good luck to everyone who's fighting the new reactors down here.